Welcome, everyone. So glad so many people made it late in the afternoon. You weren't distracted by ice cream, or maybe you've already had your ice cream. Oh, that's right. They ended ice cream right as my session was starting. I wonder who asked for that to happen. I do not deal with counter-programming well. My name is Jason DeRose. I am on the teaching faculty this week. I was also on the teaching faculty last week, so much of what I'm doing this week I did last week as well. So if you were here both times, you will hear a lot of repeated material. However, I've changed the Thursday session this week, so we won't be doing clergy sex abuse. We will be doing LGBTQ rights instead. As I said, my name is Jason DeRose, and I serve on the faculty. I also serve on the board of directors of Holden Village, so I'm always happy to talk with people about the life of the village and, you know, what you think is going well and not well at the village, and I'm always happy to have a cup of coffee or tea or a meal or something like that, or a short walk, and have those conversations with you. When I'm not here in my day job, I am the Western Bureau Chief for NPR News, and I'm also the senior editor for LGBTQ rights and religion. I also used to oversee indigenous and native coverage, but I was doing four full-time jobs, and so I gave one of them away. Because nothing happens in the world of religion or on the West Coast or with LGBTQ rights, so I gave away, my work calmed down dramatically, I'm sure, after that happened. So this week's theme is religion in American public life, and we'll be meeting every afternoon from 3:30 to 4:30. If you've come to this session and you can't come to any other session, that's great. This is the overview session. If you can come to two sessions, this session and one of the others is great. It'll work if you couldn't make it to this one. So tell your friends who couldn't make it how great it was and ask them to come. So today we'll be focusing on what is the proper role, or what could be or what should be the proper role of religion in American public life. But first, I want to talk about how I get into these issues and stories. I get into these issues and topics not through lectures, but through stories. So I want to read from you a short passage from one of my favorite books. This book was assigned to me when I was 18 years old as a freshman in college, taking a great books class, and we were reading Genesis. And it's called Texts of Terror, Literary Feminist Readings of Biblical Narratives. I'm going to read for you the first two paragraphs of the book, which helped me think not just about biblical stories, but about all stories. And as a person who's a professional storyteller, what I do is tell stories to 30 million people on the radio every day. This grounds and informs the work that I do as someone who's a professional storyteller. Now, I work in nonfiction, fact, journalism, but I think these ideas apply to people who work in other forms of storytelling as well, such as fiction. So this is from the introduction on telling sad stories. Stories are the style and substance of life. They fashion and fill existence from the primeval to eschatological vistas, from youthful dreams to seasoned experiences, from resounding disclosures to whispered intimacies. The narrative mode of speech prevails. Myth, parable, folktale, epic, romance, novella, history, confession, biography, these and other genres proclaim the presence and power of the story. If without stories we live not, stories live not without us. Alone, a text is mute and ineffectual. In the speaking and the hearing, new things appear in the land. The word goes forth from the mouth. Even the tongue of the stammerer speaks readily and distinctly. The ears of those who hear hearken, even the ears of the deaf unstop. Thus the word does not return empty, but accomplishes that which it purposes. Storytelling is a threefold act, Trinitarian, you might say. It unites the writer, the text, and the reader in a collage of understanding. Though distinguishable and unequal, these three participants are inseparable. and they're interdependent. They all depend on each other. Truly, in the tale, in the telling, we are all one blood. Again, that's a passage from a book called Texts of Terror, Literary Feminist Readings of Biblical Narratives by Phyllis Tribble. This book lives in the library in the Hebrew Bible section on the far end of the library. So, today's theme, religion is one of the most salient factors in American public life, from racial justice to LGBTQ rights, and those are two of the four things we'll be talking about this week. Belief, religion, is often deployed to fight for and against rights, the rights of others to live the lives they choose to live, to live their lives as best they see fit. Now, this session is going to explore some faith communities that have chosen to isolate themselves, some faith communities that have chosen to be very out there, and some faith communities who have figured out ways someplace in between. And I want you to all be participants in this, not just me talking to you, but we're going to listen to some stories. We're going to listen to three pieces that I've edited for, most of them aired on All Things Considered or Morning Edition, a few have aired on Weekend Edition. And then I'm going to have you get into small little groups of two or three, and I'm going to give you a question to discuss, then we're going to come back together, and you do not get to tell me what you said in that conversation. You have to tell me what somebody else said in that conversation. This is a journalistic practice, so you're going to have to listen. So, and this is why I do this, because I often find, and I find this about myself too, that when I'm in a small group and I don't have to actually report back on it, I'm just waiting to talk myself. What I want you to do is listen. So you're going to have to pay attention to what somebody else in your small group says. Before we get going on that, since the theme of this week is religion in American public life, can anybody tell me one of the places that religion is mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, in the actual body of the Constitution or the amendments?
It's the First Amendment.
It's the First Amendment. Do you remember what the First Amendment says? I'll let it. Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. So there's establishment, that's the establishment clause, and then there's the free exercise clause. Establishment means the government can't say, this is a Jewish nation, this is a Christian nation, this is a Muslim nation. Although there is a U.S. representative from Georgia who says that we should be a Christian nation. There are others. She's just the one that I think of. I can never remember how to say her name. Okay. We've done disestablishment, and how about the free exercise clause? That means that you cannot be stopped from practicing the religion of your choice, and that has also meant, in the estimation of the Supreme Court and the laws of the land, that also means you can practice no religion if you choose to practice no religion. There's another place in the Constitution. Can anybody else think of where it is? It's in the main body?
I was thinking it was in the preamble.
It's not in the preamble. Not in the preamble. Nobody has memorized Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution. This is what it says. The senators and representatives before mentioned, because this is a section about how Congress shall be formed, and the members of the several state legislatures and all executive and judicial offices, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support the Constitution, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. Now, the week before I flew here, I've been here too, this is the middle of my second week, the week before I flew here, I saw that a business called Hobby Lobby, which has in other ways affected how birth control can be distributed in the United States through insurance, has taken out a full page ad in multiple newspapers saying that we should create a religion test. They want to amend the US Constitution to say only Christians should serve in elected offices throughout the land, not just at the national level, but at the state level. So I like to point out that this is not settled law. And I think that if the Dobbs decision regarding abortion earlier this summer told us anything, it's that nothing is settled law in an era of chaotic government. So I want to start with a piece, and I want to give you a question to think about while you're listening to the piece. I'll repeat the question after we listen, and then I'd like you to turn to one or two neighbors, and I'll give you a few minutes to talk it over. So the question is, what are the benefits and drawbacks of the approach described in the piece we're about to hear? This is one approach to religion in public life. This piece is about 7 minutes long, so sit back and relax.
Many conservative religious people feel disconnected from a society they see as hostile to their beliefs. Some have organized politically, taking a stand against secular culture. Today, we begin a series of occasional stories about the way Americans exercise their faith in their daily lives. Here's NPR's Tom Gjelten on a community that has turned inward, where religious people are focused more on deepening their faith rather than defending it.
About 150 Roman Catholic families who put their faith at the very center of their lives have settled in a small Maryland suburb called Hyattsville, just outside D.C. They've moved here deliberately to be near other Catholics with the same values. Most attend the same church and send their children to the nearby Catholic school. They socialize, they have scripture study groups, and they pray together in each other's homes, as these women are doing this weekday morning.
I like to pray in Thanksgiving for just a new day of life, for marriage and family, for this community, and also for my husband's job, for his focus, taking another
The room is full of babies. 32-year-old Jane Murphy and her husband have three children under the age of five.
We're very open to life, obviously. You know, in the Catholic Church, we don't believe in artificial contraception. And that results in a lot of babies.
These Catholic families hold to official church views on family, marriage, and worship. The women pray the rosary together. They call themselves the Rosary Moms.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
The Catholics of Hyattsville are not separatists. They have non-Catholic friends, they have jobs, they vote, but they are living purposely in community.
It started with my having invited people I knew to come here.
Chris Curry moved to Hyattsville with his wife 20 years ago and joined the local parish, St. Jerome's. His sister and her family followed. It was the beginning of an intentional community.
And then we started to see, by word of mouth, people coming here to join this kind of heightened or thicker community life, including graduate students at Catholic University, faculty there, others who were moving to Washington for jobs.
Among them, Dan Gibbons.
The parish life was very important to us. And the idea that a parish isn't just a place where you come on Sunday for a couple hours.
Gibbons and his wife have four young boys.
I know from my own childhood that it can be very hard to raise children as a Catholic if you don't have a community of other Catholics who are trying hard to raise their children in ways that are harmonious with their faith.
And let's go into the trial. Please turn in your books to chapter 14.
The parish school, St. Jerome Academy, is part of what draws Catholics to this community. The curriculum includes regular science, literature, and history classes, but infused throughout are lessons about God and the value of Christian faith. This class is discussing Joan of Arc, who's said to have been divinely inspired to lead French troops against their English enemies, only to be captured and burned at the stake.
Morgan, go ahead.
Even though she's destined to be killed, she still has a reward after she's killed of going to heaven and seeing God.
Okay, so has God abandoned her?
No.
How do you think she feels?
The Hyattsville community has come to the attention of the writer Rod Dreher, who's known for his observations on contemporary Christian life. He sees the Hyattsville Catholics as an exception to an increasingly weak religious culture in this country.
I think for a lot of people in modernity, religion has become sort of like a psychological help, a way of rationalizing what we want to do anyway.
To Dreher, the Hyattsville Catholics are living a version of what, in a new book, he calls the Benedict Option, after the 6th century saint who founded one of the earliest Christian monasteries. In his book, Dreher calls on Christians to follow a modern version of that monastic life.
It means that we have to pray more intentionally. We have to learn how to fast again and how to deny ourselves things. It means that we're going to have to spend a lot more time in worship. We're going to have to burrow more deeply into the scriptures. And I think it means we're going to have to be a lot more contemplative.
The Rosary Moms end with song.
You reign now in splendor with Jesus our King.
These women are not new to their Catholic faith. Jane Murphy always went to church, but she says it was mostly an intellectual experience.
It wasn't until coming into this community that I became much more spiritual about my faith and discovering the joy that comes with my spiritual life and growing my spiritual life.
The challenge for the Hyattsville Catholics and other Christians living Rod Dreher's Benedict option is not to be so segregated as to oppose America's growing diversity. Dreher himself has faced criticism for not being sufficiently inclusive in his vision of Christian life. The Hyattsville Catholics know they're in a minority with their theologically traditional views and values. But unlike some other conservative Christians, they don't focus on their marginalization. They're not angry. They're not especially political. The community founder, Chris Curry, looks to the example of the early Christians back in Roman times.
I think that's what we're trying to do now, is live the way they did, not live defensively in sort of a paranoid, xenophobic reaction to the rest of society, but to realize that we're all human beings created in the image of God and live that life ourselves and share it with our neighbors.
Those early Christians were persecuted mightily for their faith, Curry notes, but still they thrived.
They lived joyful lives and attracted converts by the example of the lives that they were living.
And so do the Hyattsville Catholics. Their numbers are steadily growing, even as many Christian congregations deal with decline. Tom Jelton, NPR News.
It's easier to...
I very consciously play this piece in a place like Holden Village, knowing that I think that there are some resonances with this place, not so much for guests, but for long-term staff. And I see a few long-term staffers in here. So hopefully you'll be able to bring that to the conversation as well. So why don't you turn to your neighbor, groups of two or three, because I want everybody to get about a minute to talk or so. And I'm going to give you about 3 minutes to talk about the benefits and drawbacks of the Benedict option. So 3 minutes on the clock. Okay, let's come back together. I'm interested in hearing what you heard from your conversation partners. Remember, if you would like to report back to the whole group, what I'd like you to do is to not say what you said, but tell me what you heard your conversation partner say. Would anybody like to, again, this is about the benefits or drawbacks to a situation like the Benedict option. Oh, I have a microphone. By the way, this session isn't being recorded. Never mind, you're not going to be recorded. Because I did this last week, so that one was recorded. Who would like to share what you heard with your conversation partners? What are the benefits and drawbacks of this?
Hi, my name is Tim, and Callie said that Holden Village required Vespers, and it was an authoritarian thing to do. No, she didn't say that.
She looked very nervous as you were saying that.
So for the board of directors, I'm joking. But she does kind of lift up that while the values are diversity, there are some required things that could hold it all a little bit in tension.
Okay. In a place like Holden Village or in a place like the Benedict option, which we heard about in the story. Yes?
John said it doesn't seem like it would be many drawbacks to it, except what about the children and their interaction in the rest of the world? Something like that.
So perhaps less confusing for them? Except they have friends who aren't, I guess, you know. Although they go to a Catholic school and live in, you know, this community of about 150 homes, so unless they're a little older, they're certainly not driving, you know, themselves.
Yes.
Holly was saying that when you come to Holden, which is also an intentional community, the emphasis is to prepare you to go back out in the world. Mm-hmm. And so one of the big drawbacks for this other community is there is no intention to go back out to the world.
Mm. Well, I guess I hear in that story that, you know, these are people who are their graduate students at American University. They're not cloistered, but they're hoping to spend, like, a long time there. So it's, I guess it's very different from Holden in that this is a place you come for a week or two, maybe a couple of years, but nobody stays here more than 5 years, and that's only the directors, really. Whereas, you know, if you build a home, you're settling in for 30 to 40 years, probably. Yes? I know the mic slows things down, but for people, it helps for everybody to hear.
So Maddie has lived in the DC area, and they were talking about how that area where they are settling is very, very diverse. And so the implications of having such a small community and the type of people it might bring, whether it's, is their diversity reflecting the area that they're in, or potentially starting to drive people out to create a different space.
Ah, so this could be sort of, if not intentional, but not just intentional community, but sort of intentional gentrification of an area.
Maybe not.
Or maybe not. I don't know.
It could just be
accidental, a byproduct of wanting a bunch of conservative Catholics to live together.
My name is Glenn, and before I spoke, I asked my partner Cindy if it would be okay for me to share what we shared. And she said, absolutely not. And I don't know. I'm going ahead anyway. So I was trying to hear very carefully what she was saying, because I pretty much could replicate in my own, my own sense of community. So I'm going to try to separate that out. I asked her the question, would you yourself live in an intentional community? And her answer was, yes, I would, if given the opportunity. And then I asked the question, why would you want to live in an intentional community? And I think what you said was to be with people with the same values in a very diverse culture now. As a parenthetical thing to me, I understand that. This place creates intentional community. Seminary creates intentional community. The university, when you're doing a graduate program, is intentional. But we don't live in intentional communities. And the only drawback would be, what about the children? Would she be judged for that? I think you said that, didn't you? I hope I said it right. That's close enough. So, and before we publish it, we can edit it. And so that was the gist. It wasn't like, oh my God, why would anybody do that? In a sense, why wouldn't somebody do that? So, we okay? Okay.
And the reason that I wanted to start with this piece is that I think that, you know, many of us who come to a place like Holden want to come here in part because we're looking for a community that reflects our values. And, you know, as a person who wrote the mission statement, the current mission statement, or one of the people who wrote the current mission statement, I can tell you that we spent a lot of time on the mission, vision, and values of the place. And we had a lot of conversation about, like, how Christian should it be? The opening phrase is growing from the love of Christ. One of the values is we value our Lutheran roots, which give us the courage to face the world. Give us the courage to face the world with something. Hope, I believe. Don't have the whole thing memorized, unfortunately. So that's, you know, I think that's a constant conversation here, and I think it's a constant conversation in a place like Hyattsville. But I also think that can be in tension if it becomes sort of against the culture too much. One thing that I think about interesting about this story, so this is a community of 150 homes. What if it gets to be 300, 400 homes? What if it gets to be more, and suddenly they need a city council person, or they need, you know, some kind of county representative? And so then will it take on something different? Right now they say they're not interested in politics, but I wonder how big they might get before they start being interested in politics. Okay, well, I want to play another piece for you, which is... a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Maybe four at the most.
Because one of our questions was in the current climate of extreme polarization.
That's the next piece.
Okay. Okay.
I know what I'm doing. So I want to play another piece for you about another kind of way to think about a church existing in the world. The question that I'd like you to think about is that what is the proper role of religion in public life? For those of you who are from the Lutheran tradition, I think there's a lot of good material to think about in the two kingdoms, that people exist sort of between the kingdom of, well, I guess one way to translate it, the kingdom of the earth and the kingdom of heaven. So think about that tension in the next piece we're going to hear. And I'd like you to think about that question. What is the proper role when you have people behaving the way they're behaving in the piece I'm about to play for you?
If anyone thought that Christian nationalism would decline with Donald Trump out of power, they were mistaken. The movement of conservative evangelical churches that believes America must regain its Christian roots is stronger than ever. Yet more and more mainline Christian congregations are speaking out to say that Christian nationalism is wrong, NPR's John Burnett reports.
The Sunday service at the Patriot Church in the town of Lenoir City, Tennessee, starts out like a lot of evangelical worship. Hands aloft, Bibles in laps, full-throated singing. When Reverend Ken Peters picks up his wireless mic, the service takes a sharp turn to the right.
Don't let the mainstream media or the left tell you that we were not a Christian nation. You know why there's churches everywhere and not mosques? Because we're a Christian nation.
The sermon, titled How Satan Destroys the World, zigzags between familiar grievances of conservative Christians, like abortion and trans rights. But what makes this church different is its embrace of the contemporary agenda of the far right. Masks and vaccinations violate religious freedom. The participants in the January 6th riot were proud patriots. The Biden administration is evil and illegitimate.
You know he's not the most popular president in America. How many Biden parades did you see? Yet he beat Trump with 70 million. Give me a break. We know something's up.
Christian nationalism is on the march, providing a godly underpinning for right-wing activism in venues like school board elections and anti-vaccine protests. The movement holds that America is Christian, that the government should keep it that way, and Donald Trump was and is their best hope to accomplish that. After the service, I sit down with Jim Willis, a 72-year-old retired Army colonel and software salesman who wears on his lapel an American flag inside of a Christian cross.
This is a spiritual battle. It's good versus evil.
Willis says he and his wife fled California for Tennessee because of heavy-handed COVID restrictions, and the Holy Spirit led them to the Patriot Church, which is not afraid to jump into the fight.
And unfortunately, evil's taken charge. And we know what their agenda is. Their agenda is to close down churches, to get rid of religion permanently in this country.
When I point out that President Biden is a lifelong Catholic who attends weekly Mass, he responds,
"No, he isn't. No, he isn't."
In this partisan fissure that we're living in, imperviousness to facts is a sign of the times. I head outside to talk to Murray Clementson, a law school student and father of three kids, all homeschooled. He was among the 80% of white evangelicals who voted for Trump in 2020.
Is this a Donald Trump church?
I think it is a Donald Trump church. Donald Trump represented what we stand for as a nation. You go to flyover country, and people have good moral values. They love the Lord, and they want the best for the country. And that's what Donald Trump tapped into. That's what he represented.
The next morning, I return to Lenoir City, to the barn-like building with the American flag painted on the roof that's home to the Patriot Church. It came into being while Trump was president, and it's done well. There are currently 4 campuses in Tennessee, Virginia, and Washington State with about 350 members. 2 more locations are on the way. Reverend Peters greets me with a warm handshake. He's a rising star on the Christian right and one of the few MAGA church leaders who welcomes journalists. Peters believes so fervently that his candidate won, he went to the Stop the Steal rally in Washington, D.C. and addressed protesters the day before the Capitol riot. I told him that one of his parishioners said his church is a Donald Trump church.
We love Donald Trump. We love him. We will be accused a lot of worshiping him or being part of his religion as if he's some sort of cult and work. No, Donald Trump passes away tomorrow, God forbid. Does that stop us? Does that slow us down? Not one bit. We'll be looking for the next guy to lead the way.
The rise of Christian nationalism is both a symptom and an accelerant of the polarization that afflicts America. But there's more and more pushback. Last year, a long list of mainstream and progressive church leaders signed an open letter that condemned Christian nationalism as a distortion of the faith and idolatrous of the former president. That letter and the proximity of the Patriot Church motivated one congregation just up the highway to take a stand. Church of the Savior is perched on a bluff overlooking Interstate 40 in Knoxville. It's a liberal, inclusive congregation that's part of the United Church of Christ. Senior pastor John Gill stood at the pulpit one recent Sunday and started his sermon this way.
I think many of us believed and hoped that the fever of misinformation about the election and the pandemic and all the related efforts to undermine democracy in our nation would somehow abate. But that's not happening.
Indeed, he says, things have gotten worse.
It's difficult for me to understand how those who embrace this ideology can call themselves Christian and so thoroughly ignore Jesus' call to nonviolence.
The youth minister at the Church of the Savior is 58-year-old Reverend Tanya Barnett. She sits with a group of church members who agreed to be interviewed. She says Christian Trumpism has also broken out in the Pentecostal churches where she grew up in Appalachia.
My family would go to the Patriot Church if there were one around Big Stone Gap, Virginia. The churches they go to teach the same things.
Reverend Barnett is lesbian. She says her sexuality and her progressive church are still rejected by some members of her family in the coal town of Big Stone Gap. She says she understands why people in the Patriot Church are scared.
I think it's some kind of fear of difference, fear of me as being different, fear of the nation changing so that it's not white, cis, straight, male Christians in charge only, and it's moving more toward people who are different.
Barnett says, in her opinion, Christian patriots are completely missing the true message of the gospel.
Wanting to gain power as Christian nationalists is in direct opposition to what Jesus taught. Compassion, kindness, and care for the people who are most oppressed. That's what Jesus did.
I mean, there's nothing new about Christian nationalism. It's been part of this country's history for a long time, decades.
Ed Sullivan is a 55-year-old librarian who goes to Church of the Savior. As he observes, the Bible has been thrust into Republican politics long before the Patriot Church. Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority helped to get conservative Christians involved in politics back in the 1980s.
But the Patriot Church movement is certainly the most extreme manifestation of that we have today.
Is there any hope, I ask him, to narrow the chasm that separates these two churches in eastern Tennessee that both profess to follow Jesus?
If they view anyone who dissents with their point of view as evil or the enemy or of the devil, I really don't see how there's any kind of common ground that can be found.
I put the same question to Reverend Peters of the Patriot Church. He's not optimistic either. He said they don't want a civil war, but coexistence is increasingly difficult in the same United States. John Burnett, NPR News, Knoxville, Tennessee.
This piece is part of a year-long project that John and I are working on, a called Divided America, where he goes to find people on such extremes who somehow manage to live near each other and sometimes interact, but sometimes don't interact. with each other. So I'd like you to turn to a different person than you turned the last time, and talk with them about the question that I posed before. So what should the proper role be? We have now heard the Benedict option. We have this other option suggested here by Patriot Church. And we have something else by that UCC church, but I'm not sure what it is. Fear not, there is a third piece you will be listening to. We're going to get to that after you have this conversation. Take about 3 minutes to chat with your neighbor, not the same neighbor as last time. And remember, you're going to report back on what somebody else said, not what you said. Together and share what we heard from your conversation partners. Remember, I'm not asking you to say what you said in your conversation, but rather what you heard. So you're going to report back like a good journalist. So who would like to, I'm so glad everybody's really into this conversation. So who would like to share what you heard from your conversation partner? There was a lot of talking. I was also told that you should count to seven after asking a question like that to give people a few seconds to gather themselves and think of what they should say. So I'm now at six. Okay, yes.
I don't have a mic up here, but okay. I'll... Juliana,
yep.
That's my partner, and she talked about she would like the church to be involved, and she'd like to see leadership and statements about our unhoused neighbors, Black Lives Matter, gun safety, and we talked about together about speaking up for our neighbors who don't have a voice.
So when you say you'd like the church to be involved, what is, like, the church as like the church doing something, or individuals within the church? What would you like to see?
I think that we have there's moral leadership, and I hate that term because I think it gets used. In ways that make me sick to my stomach. I think it's worth it to risk it. Could be wrong, but I think that church leadership should be out in front and speaking up for marginalized people, because I think that's what we're called to do.
So you may be aware that the ELCA is in the process of developing a social statement right now on the role of the church in public life and politics. So this is something that you could actually probably get your congregation to like actually do a study on. I think it would be a really good idea for all congregations to think this through and offer your feedback to the ELCA. I assume that other denominations have either done or are doing this as well. So this would be a good opportunity to start thinking in that way with your congregation. I also think that it's interesting. I mean, I've done versions of this question with other pieces before, and one thing that often comes up is, well, if the Christian Nationalist Church is speaking so loudly and so clearly, there needs to be another representation of Christianity, or an actual representation of Christianity, some might say, in public life. And so, you know, mainline Protestants who, you know, spent a quarter of a century fighting about gay clergy might want to think about the rest of the world instead of themselves in the future until they have to close up shop because they've run out of people, which is a real possibility, I think. And I think that, I think that sometimes pastors, and I hear this all the time when I interview pastors or when my reporters interview pastors, they are frightened to death to say anything that's going to offend anybody in their congregations. And I think there are ham-handed and lousy ways to talk about politics from the pulpit, but there are ways that, you know, use the Bible well, that talk about the gospel, that say things like, you know, Jesus might have something to say about the death penalty having been executed publicly. I'm always fascinated by the like divide on the death penalty in America. Because it's a very popular thing in America, actually. Every time the state of California has tried to overturn the death penalty by public vote, by like a plebiscite, it always loses. And so approximately 60% of Californians are fine with it. But, you know, this is two-thirds of Californians voted for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump.
Can I ask you a question? What do you think Jesus said about it? I thought he...
I don't know that he said anything about it, but I think that
he experienced
execution by the state for his crimes.
Can I just because
you've spoken already, Doug?
Yeah, this might be a little off topic, but I'm listening to this Christian involvement in government. And one of my things has always been, why don't they pay taxes then? Why are churches tax exempt if they want to be such a big part of the politics? Yeah. They should be paying members.
That's a good question. So there's a rule about how churches can, or how religious house of faith can do this. The government draws the line at, you cannot endorse specific candidates, but you can talk about issues. So you can't say, vote for Donald Trump. I would actually say that the Patriot Church is probably saying that. It seems to me that they're saying that. I don't know why they're not being investigated by the IRS. Maybe the IRS doesn't have enough people to do investigations. That's part of it. But I also think we would see an even bigger culture war if an IRS during a Democratic administration started investigating things like the Patriot Church. But what churches can do is take stance on issues like the death penalty. For instance, the ELCA has a very strong stance against the death penalty. But here's what I find really fascinating. If you poll ELCA congregations, it's 50-50. Now, not by individual congregation. Because in the United States, most congregations, and I know that some people say they belong to a purple congregation, but the Public Religion Research Institute has done all sorts of research on this. It's a tiny, tiny group of congregations that are truly purple, like about 50-50. Most are 80% one or the other, and that 20% doesn't show up all the time. They're sort of like, they're not like core members of those congregations. So, you know, churches are as divided on this. Now, within a denomination, that might not be the case, because I think the ELCA is somewhat fairly divided. However, by congregation, it's deeply, deeply divided. Yes.
I know I'm double dipping here, but I want to ask the question of you or anyone else. I have never thought that poverty is a religious issue or death penalty. I've always thought it's a moral issue. And I personally know how I can separate that. But the things we think about, well, you know, the church should be involved, and I believe that, but I believe everyone should be involved, whether church or not, because for me, it is homelessness is not a religious issue. It's a moral issue in our culture. And I think, well...
What I actually hear you saying is that it is not just a religious issue, that there could be people who are not religious who also, for moral reasons, want to fight poverty.
Well, last week when I heard the Muslim speak, I could be sitting in a Christian church. And I think, why...
I was referring to a speaker last week that we had who was talking about Muslim understandings of charity,
but
which will be archived and online someday.
Yeah, but he spoke about many things that were... corresponding to what we call Christian beliefs, and I don't know why we keep saying it's a moral issue across the board for all churches, all mosques, all centers of religion.
Glenn is not a plant, but that leads perfectly into the final piece I was going to play for you, because I want. And anybody here from Oregon? Oh, good, enough people from Oregon for this to make. Like, you will understand deeply what this is about, because it's about your state. So I've presented a couple of different ways that people might or might not be involved in public life through their congregation. So I want to play this piece for you, and I don't necessarily know what the question is that I want you to think about. Maybe it is, you know, what pattern does this demonstrate that's different from the previous versions that we've heard, Patriot Church, that UCC Church, and the Benedict option Catholics. But also, which of these approaches do you think might be the best approach? Or is there a better approach? We're not going to have a ton of time for conversation afterwards. Actually, this isn't bumping up against another session, so if we go over by about 5 minutes, I don't think that's going to be the end of the world.
In Oregon, a gun control measure will likely appear on the November ballot. It's an effort born primarily of religious rather than political organizing. Katie Riddle reports from Portland.
A turning point for Rabbi Michael Z. Kahana was the Parkland shooting in Florida 4 years ago. After so many such tragedies, he was growing tired of listening to himself just talk about gun violence.
Yes, the rabbi can get up and can give yet another sermon. And I was giving a lot of sermons on this subject. And that's not enough.
His faith and a feeling of desperation from his own congregation, Beth Israel, helped push him beyond thoughts and prayers.
They have to have action.
Kahana led his Portland synagogue into an effort to change the law in Oregon. If Measure 17 passes, the state will require safety training and background checks for people purchasing guns. High-capacity magazines will be banned altogether.
And so when we were able to say, and here is something you can do, can start gathering signatures right now to get this on the ballot, that got people engaged.
Synagogues, church, mosques, temples, that's where a lot of the good movements start.
Pastor Mark Knutson is standing in the basement of his Augustana Lutheran Church in Northeast Portland. It's buzzing with energy. A dozen volunteers sort signatures in tidy piles. Knutson says it's in part history that inspires this effort.
The civil rights movement came out of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, you know, Dexter Avenue in Montgomery, and I've been there. I've done those in, out of a little church basement, can have amazing things.
Knutson recruited rabbis and imams, Native American spiritual leaders, and evangelical ministers. Getting the measure on the Oregon ballot requires 112,000 signatures. It's a number they say they've surpassed, with a surge of support after recent shootings.
After Uvalde, especially, we sent, and the first day out, 800 packets for people who want to be circulators.
Simone Martin is the campaign organizer here. She says at one point they were hurting for circulators to gather signatures. After Uvalde, they had more than they knew what to do with.
Oh my gosh, it was almost overwhelming. Like, I still have people wanting to volunteer now.
At one point, volunteer Joe Paterno was collecting signatures 7 days a week. He's a member of this Lutheran congregation.
I can't separate my faith from this work and this kind of movement.
In the days leading up to the signature gathering deadline, Paterno is working outside a grocery store. Advocating for gun control, he says, is how he lives out his faith.
It's what we should all be about, as caring for each other.
Despite the religious foundation of this effort, volunteers say God is not really a talking point in the campaign. Delivery driver Steve McMullen has just signed. He leans on his dolly while he chats with Paterno.
Whereas our best weapon is talking to each other.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or just using your feet and walking away from a situation.
Mostly conversations go more like this one. Volunteers appealing to people out of common sense. Reiner Gottes also gathers signatures in this parking lot.
Coming from Germany, I never understood the gun culture here in the United States.
Gottes says after more than 15 years here, he's never stopped being shocked at how easily people can kill each other. He's wearing a cap that reads, "Out of the Closet Atheist." He says it's the issue that drew him to this cause.
For me, it's a clear-cut thing. You know, less guns means less violence.
He's just got a signature from Mary Elizabeth Smith. She says this effort won't eliminate gun violence, but it can't hurt.
Even if it is just a Band-Aid, it's still something, you know?
Gotta start somewhere.
Yeah, you gotta start somewhere.
Smith grew up Christian. She no longer considers herself a part of the church, but she says she still tries to live many of the teachings of Christ that she was raised with. She's happy to support this effort that was organized by people of faith.
Yeah, it's great. Using religion for good is always a good thing.
Smith says there's no use of an assault rifle that's Christ-like. For NPR News, I'm Katie Riddle in Portland, Oregon.
It's easier to...
It made it. Yes, it will be on the ballot. And I think it was also supported by the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, because all the mainline churches were sent petitions of...
Right, right. So this is an example.
You would think I would know how to use a microphone, given my job.
So this is an example of people of faith not acting like as a church, like the Lutheran Church says, but mobilizing their communities, mobilizing congregations. You know, probably not everybody in those in every congregation was thrilled by this, but it was a way to motivate enough people. I always wonder, though, I mean, and this, as I said, comes up, like, did any of these pastors or imams or rabbis hear from the congregants who aren't happy that they were using time and energy to do that? I bet they did. I bet they did. Yes.
When Cindy and I have been involved in faith-based community organizing, yes.
Yes, you hear from the unhappy.
We hear from those who are not happy, but the changes that can be made by working within the community with people of faith or non-faith or very different faith who are willing to do that and make changes, and it actually, to me, works so much better than a church as a whole trying to do the same thing, because the crosstalk really it makes a huge difference in the unity of the effort.
What I find so interesting about this specific ballot in this specific place is that, like, Oregon is, I believe, either the or the almost or like the second least churched state in the country. And so you've got fewer people going to church yet, or any house of worship, and they managed to do this thing, which is pretty amazing considering there aren't many of them.
Like, gun culture.
Well, right, in a state that is very big on gun culture. Now, who knows how this is going to go? You know, in about what's that? 6 weeks away is election day, or 8 weeks away? So,
and how much money the gun lobby will put
right.
into ads?
Right, right. So, any other final thoughts before I do just wrap up a little bit and give you a little preview for tomorrow?
I don't need the mic, but I think it's
pretty cool. Well, I just want people to make sure they can hear you. It's a little hard to hear if you're upstairs.
I think what you said about the Oregon situation shows that the non-church people care as much as the church people about life and about things. I know not every non-church person feels that way, but I think...
We have the out-of-the-closet atheist in the piece for a reason. And I specifically said to the reporter, like, not a lot of people go to church in that state. Like, find some who don't, who are interested in this. And the last two people in the piece are that. I love the last line of this piece. I mean, as soon as she called me, as soon as she'd done the interview before she got in the car, and she was like, someone just said, like, there's no Christ-like way to use an assault rifle. And I was like, well, that's your kicker in the story. That is the end of this piece. That's not what you say, Katie Riddle, the reporter, but that's what she says, and that's a really nice close to the piece.
Jason, can I just say something about the previous piece, just in case people don't know that the Patriot Church is in Moses Lake.
In Washington.
Yeah, and that there is a big, you know, tour going around with Franklin Graham and so forth, and there is going to be one on the Idaho-Washington border coming up, and there was one in New York, and it got relocated based on faith leaders, and faith communities organizing against it. And that's also happening sort of as we speak in Spokane, that people are coming together to speak out a different voice than what people are going to hear at that rally. So I just want folks to know that.
Yeah, in fact, I just got an email a couple of days ago about the one that's happening in Idaho. I think it's happening
is
next
it
month.
Is it Idaho, Washington border?
Is it next month? Is it
September 17th?
So that's it. Yeah. You sent it to me, Stacey.
Yeah.
You sent me that email because you know this is what I do.
Oh, yeah.
I spend my days thinking about Christian nationalism. That's what I thought I was going to do after divinity school. So just I want to give you a little preview for tomorrow's... One more person. Because we're running over, and I want to be respectful of people's times.
I just want to say that our pastor and leaders in the church do not have to sort of openly talk about politics. They don't have to, because in my congregation, we hear every Sunday, in one way or the other, to love your neighbor and follow Jesus' teaching. And so if that is spread out, you know, you don't have to say, vote for this person or the other person. You vote for people who are standing up for justice and peace.
I understand that sentiment. I also think that the people in Patriot Church are reading the same Bible that your congregation is reading, and they're hearing something very different from love your neighbor, because I think that they think that their neighbors might just be their actual neighbors and not the community. So I think that's true, but I think that sometimes churches and other religious leaders need to help people figure out what it means to love your neighbor. And I think that is what a sermon is really all about, isn't it? It's how does this text help you figure out how to love your neighbor? So a little bit of a preview about the rest of the week. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about racial justice, religion's role in racial justice in the United States. Thursday, we're going to talk about religion's role in LGBTQ rights in the United States. And on Friday, what are we doing Friday? Abortion rights in the United States. And as far as me thinking about, sometimes people ask me, like, well, what do you think about these stories? Or sometimes people ask me, what should I think about these stories? Getting back to that Phyllis Trible passage I read from you, I think it's important to tell the stories, and I want you to make the meaning. In my telling, in your hearing, there is meaning being made in these stories. So what I like to say is, I'm helping you, I'm giving you some things to think about, but I'm not giving you what to think. So that's the point of this week's session. So I hope you'll come back. Thanks for coming today. Thank you.